Hello and welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Bird, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And thanks to this movie, fuck, I feel gross right now.
Oh yeah, no, we're finally ending. It's late November, so of course we are finally ending our Halloween human body gross out a-thon. Only 1 month and to almost the day late. And we're ending it as anyone would, of course, end any horror movie marathon, with a Mel Brooks film. Technically, this is David Cronenberg's, produced by Brooks Films, The Fly.
I think you're making a mistake. I think you really want to talk to me.
Sorry, I have 3 other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
If you saw how scared and angry and desperate he is...
I'm sure Typhoid Mary was a very nice person, too, when you saw her socially.
No!
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
Wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no.
A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone.
Don't go back to it.
Could be contagious.
I'm afraid!
Don't be afraid!
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Just both funny and true.
Yeah. It's also one of my favorite things about The Elephant Man. Brilliant, serious, so award-winning. Oh, God, the award-winningness. Produced by the greatest director of all time, in my personal opinion, and maybe 3 other people. But fuck you, I work for Mel Brooks. I want to get that tattoo. When he dies, I'm going to go to a tattoo parlor and get someone to, like, black outline draw Slim Pickens, and under it, it just says, "Piss on you, I work for Mel Brooks."
Nice. Oh, yeah, no, that definitely needs to happen. Not the Mel Brooks dying part, but the tattoo.
Listen, if Mel Brooks is immortal, I am okay with this. Yeah, I don't give a shit about the implications that is for, like, you know, human spirituality or our place in the universe or why no other person was immortal beforehand or any of that shit. I don't care. The minute he realizes that he can keep making movies, done. We're good. Oh, yeah.
And the best part there is, you know who else doesn't care? Mel Brooks.
Yeah, and like, you know, God bless the guy for so many reasons. But I love that in the 70s and 80s, he was like, you know, I'm well known for making comedies, but I am also an artist and intellectual person at heart. And so he set up Brooks Films to produce other people's movies that are like untouchable by the studios because they're just too much of a gamble. And funny enough, his gambles always turn out to be like fantastic successes, with the exception of High Anxiety. We don't talk about that.
I'll just assume I should be glad that I don't think I've ever heard of it.
It's his attempt to make a... So, okay. People like to think, oh, Mel Brooks films, you know, there was Blazing Saddles, there was Young Frankenstein, there was History of the World Part 1. Then there was Men in Tights, and then there was Dracula Dead and Loving It, and then the producers came back. So, you know, it starts with the producers, ends with the producers. In the late 80s, there is a series of not very good films. One takes place in a version of Nazi Germany as conceived through MTV of the late 80s. And the other is an Alfred Hitchcock pastiche. Neither are very good. No, not the best. Not the best. And so, like, it's very funny that at the same time he was producing this and The Elephant Man, he himself was at his absolute creative fucking, like, low. Spaceballs had come and gone. We are now doing just whatever I have left in the tank before we get to Men in Tights, which honestly is the last real gasp of anything interesting. Dead and Loving It. I'm so sorry, Leslie Nielsen and Mel Brooks. It's just not very good, even for your work.
Yeah, I honestly can't think of anything that would have been better after Men in Tights either, really.
Yeah, it doesn't work from there.
Yeah, I don't even remember really hearing about Mel Brooks, period, after that point.
So after that, for a couple, like, I want to say 10 years or so, there was pretty much nothing. You know, Brooks Films continued producing some stuff, like mostly minor productions. But he was, throughout that period, writing the Broadway production of The Producers, which remains to this day the most successful, I believe, Tony Award winning show of all time. So he was busy. He just shifted to something entirely different.
Fair enough.
And succeeded immediately with, again, what the movie of the Broadway show is not very good, but the Broadway show itself is truly breathtaking. And I'm a big fan of the original Producers. But anyway, that's talking about other stuff. At the time that he was, like, as I said, at his, like, creative nadir, this was coming out. And this is essentially, like, quintessential David Cronenberg. If you had a gun to your head and someone was like, name one David Cronenberg film immediately, or, like, convince me that a David Cronenberg film is good, that his oeuvre is good, that is worth it, the answer is The Fly. It's quintessential, and it's stripped down. This is such wonderfully basic, simple Psy horror character drama.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to say to me, name a David Cronenberg movie, but before we started doing this, I probably would have gone to Existenz just because that was the first one I saw. So that's probably the first thing, like, I think of.
There's nothing wrong with Existenz.
Its
biggest flaw was being released, first of all, to direct to DVD. Ouch. But also in the wake, if I recall, of The Matrix, and packaged by the company that released it as essentially a cheap knockoff Matrix. So,
Yeah. But that's it. If you were to ask me, if someone were to ask me to define body horror, I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to sit them in front of a TV and put on The Fly.
Yeah. Like, this is where that entire concept in Rick and Morty of Cronenberg universe comes from. It's just one film. It's one character. But it's so brilliantly done, and And honestly, it's firing on all cylinders on all levels. It's funny that like who's involved in this? Like Howard Shore is the composer of it, and that's amazing. It's Howard Shore. He's fantastic. Even in the 80s, when he's still like relatively new, he's doing great work. But so much of this film is silent on the soundtrack, and it's like some people may say like, oh, he cheaped out, or they cheaped out on paying him, or he didn't bother to write anything for that. But that silence works so goddamn well that if you went and bought the Fly soundtrack and the music doesn't begin until about 25 minutes into listening to it, I would honestly think that is the most brilliant thing ever.
Frankly, yeah. I mean, if you can get someone to pay for 25 minutes of nothing and then some music. I mean, I'm sorry. You have accomplished something. But also, to be perfectly honest, as I was watching the movie, I stopped noticing the score entirely.
Yeah, it's not that it's unnoticeable. It's just it works.
Yeah, no, it blends.
Yeah. So this is, first of all, this is considered a classic, an absolute classic. It's an 80s classic. It's a body horror classic. It's a David Cronenberg classic. It is one of those quintessential. Again, I'm bringing it right back to like when Space the Imagination Station started up, it was more of a sci-fi horror channel. And this was one of their mainstays. This was a pillar. Yeah. I'm sure when they were designing the brand, they had it like a photo of Goldblum's ass from this film up on a wish board. And it's just the Goldblum ass, the Brundlefly ass is how we get to another year and another budget. And from there we can move on, but we make our money off Brundlefly ass. And to me, it has that beautiful, just like passion and dirtiness to it. It's so like, god damn, it is like a perfectly concise film script, performance, everything is tight. It is only an hour and a half. It's like I said, it's a remake technically of a 1958 film, The Fly, the classic help me, which is based on a novel that came out in 1957, written by George Langoland, called The Fly. Listen, the title is very straight fucking forward here.
Will everyone in the theater hold on firmly to his seat, please? I'm Vincent Price. What unearthly horror did that girl gaze upon? What manner of incredible thing walked beneath that hood? It would be unfair at this time to show you any more of what went on in that laboratory where a man actually dared to play God. So fantastic, words can't begin to describe it. You must see it with your own eyes to believe it. When the fly comes your way.
Isn't like any other fly I've ever seen.
No! Please let me look at the fly.
I've killed Andre. Please help me. Call the police and...
The charge can only be murder.
There were no mistresses. I had no lovers.
Why did you kill him?
God, don't let it get out.
Inspector, it's in the garden. Come quickly.
As God is my witness, I saw the thing. It's unbelievable. I shall never forget that scream as long as I live.
The fly is on its way. Watch out for it. It's far beyond anything your mind could ever conceive.
But Whereas the original film has the mutation, the splicing occur immediately so that you can get that cool fly head on human body and human head on fly body, and they go off and have stupid adventures until things become untenuous. This is only about the process of the mutation and what that does. And I love that it takes what is essentially just it's a 1950s, oh God, mad science, and turns it accidentally. David Cronenberg did not see this metaphor, by the way, into an AIDS epidemic allegory in the middle of the AIDS epidemic.
You know what? I'm going to tell you right now, Cronenberg was not the only one who didn't see it. But, like, literally, as you're saying that, I'm just sitting here like, well, damn, she's right.
Right? So, like, it's not intended, because that's not how the creative team came to it.
Yeah.
They came to it with the approach of it is, it's an allegory about disease and all that. But, like, the timing and the body horror fact of it, and the way that, like, Gina Davis's character is terrified about having had it passed on sexually. There's so many aspects to it that for a mid-80s audience, it just immediately plays into all of those fears.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, personally, just having seen so many fan discussions of movies where they're like, well, clearly the film was about this, this, and this. And 9 times out of 10, I'm sitting there going, where in the blue hell did you get that from?
Now, see, General Hux represents the gold standard. And his sudden and inevitable treason and betrayal. Anyway.
It's just to have like an accidental metaphor like that that just makes so much perfect sense, and it's just right there. It's just like, it's just refreshing. It really is.
Yeah, it makes sense, and it works, and it's maybe it wouldn't have worked under another creative team, because this initially had a different director. Everything was ready to roll with Robert Bierman, and unfortunately, his daughter died tragically, and ooh, so the project got paused. They initially took it to David Cronenberg before Robert Bierman, but David Cronenberg was making in pre-production of Total Recall, and oh my God, I really wish I could see that universe's version, and not to say it's a separate production. This is the Total Recall produced by Dino De Laurentiis that would later become Total Recall, three boobs and all. Like, the beautiful classic sci-fi Arnie Fest. David Cronenberg was working on that initially. So that's fun. That's neat.
I feel like there are things about Total Recall that make more sense now. And there are also aspects around certain characters where I'm going, okay, I'm kind of curious what Cronenberg would have done with that character.
Quaid.
Yep.
Yeah.
First place I went.
Yeah, Kuatu is like you can feel the Cronenberg just like coming out of Kuatu.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. So because of the tragedy in Bierman's life, there was a pause on the pre-production, and that pause was extended to the point that the producers, like Brooks Film, wanted to get going. And you know, Bierman said, no, I can't. I can't come back to work on this so relatively quickly, whatever. Like, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm out. But it took so long that Cronenberg had separated and parted ways from Dino De Laurentiis, and thus He was free. He was wide open. And he came in and agreed with all the ideas of the writers. There was a pretty decent rewrite, but like, it was more like, oddly enough, toning down concepts. There was a monkey cat, essentially.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Brundle makes a genetic nightmare, which he just like keeps and abuses. And it's like this makes Brundle an immediate villain instead of just kind of a weirdo. And also makes it really obvious that maybe, perhaps, you should not get in the fucking machine. Like, there's a reason. There's a very clear living reason right here that is ornery and pissy. Don't do it. And so they decide, no, fuck that shit. Fuck that shit. And it just became this super tight three characters, really only three characters, study about Brundlefly's or Brundle's first obsession. That then turns to horror and then turns to attempted. Do you call it murder if technically everyone's alive, but those identities are dead? It's the Tuvix. The Tuvix legal conundrum. Are you murdering if you splice or unsplice a being? Did Captain Janeway overtly kill a sentient being and, because it was the only member of its species, commit genocide in the same act?
Well, to put the genocide aspect aside for a moment, because let's be honest, that's a debate that would be its own episode. And God knows that is an answer I do not have. In Janeway's defense, at the very least, her solution with Tuvix did not involve splicing a third being into the mix. Third and a half. I don't know how you count that, all things considered.
No, this is very true. It is a reverse of the problem, but like, come on. Shove Tuvix into the teleporter first, let him be buffered and saved, bring him back, then pull the buffer out, make a copy, I know you can do it, you bitch, then separate one of your two vixes. So technically you're still murdering a two vix, but you have another two vix, so it's okay. Morally, kind of, ends justify the means-ishly.
True, but
it's the Hugh Jackman equation. You gotta kill one of your Hugh Jackmans if you've got two Hugh Jackmans.
And also, I know somebody listening to this discussion is gonna want to bring in Thomas Riker. Now,
yes.
Yes, technically you could transport a clone, and Thomas Riker is the precedent for that.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is,
he becomes a terrorist, and therefore it's implicit that your teleporter clone is evil.
The other problem,
except for Boimler's just dies.
there's also the simple fact that in Thomas Riker's case, there are certain aspects to that were simply not available to Janeway. Could it have still been done? Possibly.
We can sit here and make excuses for Captain Janeway until the stars burn out. But the truth is, Starfleet covered up multiple crimes. Look into it. Do your research, people. Do your research.
Oh, we need an Alex Jones-esque Star Trek podcast.
I was thinking that'd be hilarious. Just diving into like every little nuance and controversy, but one, treating it as true; two, treating it like a conspiracy fucking lunatic. The Borg are already here. They're in your breakfast cereal. Wake up!
Oh my god. Oh, that really would be amazing, actually.
We'll workshop that one. but back to Brundle Fly. This is a rarity for us because we tend to watch a lot of shit.
Yeah.
This is an Academy Award winning film for obviously makeup visuals. Holy shit, because the entire film is built around the visual representation of his decay of character. And they do it beautifully. They start subtle and it ends not subtle.
And also the really nice and I thought frankly classy thing that they did. Whose name is first on the end credits?
Can't think.
The makeup artist.
Whose? They all ask. Yes. And that is absolutely like again, this is a film made for film's sake. It's like the art of it, damn it. The art of it. This is Mel Brooks just being like, here, do it. And I love that pans out, like that attitude and approach pans out in the fact that yes, the second you're done watching this incredible film and the film ends the minute the story's done, nothing more happens. Done. Go to black. And here's the credits for who did what you just saw. Who is responsible for what I just watched? Ah, you creative and talented bastards, you. The names being one goddamn moment. Chris Wallace and Stéphane Dupuis. Sweet Jesus. Incredible work.
That's, yeah. Like,
there is, you know, looking at it, that's like, okay, that's a model, that's makeup, that's like an underseam makeup effect, blah, 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 blah. You know the mechanics of it if you are enough of a film nerd, sci-fi nerd, horror movie nerd, what have you. There is no moment when watching this film, like while watching, for me, The Thing, where I step out and go, oh, that's really well done. Oh, wow, such technique. No, no, no. The technique is so good, I stay invested in this film the whole time. And just like, yep, they turned Jeff Goldblum into a fly monster. It actually happened. Jeff Goldblum's been dead since 1986. Gino Davis blew his fucking head off.
Whereas, actually, I went completely the other way where... during the final act, I was respecting the hell out of this movie because I was applauding the makeup work, which also at that point was really the only thing keeping my lunch down, but...
Yeah, how'd you like the sequence when, like, he molts his body? He molts his body. His body molts off.
Now, with that, the same as with our review of Audition, I had to go back and rewatch roughly, I think, about the middle third or so of the movie because I knew that there were parts that I missed because I nodded off just because the first time around I was watching it so late.
Mm.
So I was watching that section earlier today on my lunch break at work.
Oh, delightful.
While eating.
Ah, so good. So good.
During the molting scene.
Tasty.
And I'm still nauseous. And this may be the only episode that you will ever hear me say this. I applaud this movie for making me ill.
Yeah, because it does it with technique, not cheats. It's not just like gore for the sake of gore. It's unique. It's so creative. It's committing 100% to representing a character through a grotesquerie instead of just like some B-level like horror crap. Like, you know, you can do grotesque. It's super easy to do grotesque. But for that to have meaning, that's artistry.
And also with, I believe it's the molting scene specifically. Watch me make a diehard connection. Now, like, you know how there's that famous story in Die Hard about how when Alan Rickman is dropped from the Nakatomi Plaza and they told him, okay, we're just going to be 1, 2, 3, and then we're going to let you go. And then yeah. They let him go on 2. Now, with the molting scene in this movie and like in Die Hard, Alan Rickman's surprise is genuine. With the molting scene in The Fly, when Jeff Goldblum's ear falls off, Gina Davis didn't know.
Yeah, and it's small things like that. It's so easy to get great, honest reactions when you simply, you know, you don't lie necessarily to the actor, but you just don't tell them everything that's about to happen. That's how we ended up with the original terrific dinner scene in Alien. The actors knew that generally what was going to happen, but they had no idea, say, the violence of it.
Yeah.
And so the reactions there, the reactions from Gina Davis, those are honest responses to something really fucking disgusting and terrifying occurring right in front of them that they did not in their wildest dreams ever conceive of.
Yeah, I mean who wants to be told ahead of time when a piece of their boyfriend is about to fall off right in front of them?
and yeah, like, they do such excellent work making the stages of Brondofly more and more grotesque in tiny detailed ways, like how he becomes kind of slimy and grotesque and lumpy and glumpy, and it's just you can see the decay occur and you can almost smell it through the TV. It's so brilliant.
Yeah, and even just with things just as simple as Brundle's apartment itself, where at the start of the movie, it's the neat, tidy, well-kept, yet still run-down home of an eccentric scientist that you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the movie, not so much.
Yeah, by the end of it, it's just pure like chaos of response and need, response and need.
Yeah,
like,
it's
get left, move on next.
Yeah, it's literally an indoor dump, which
yeah,
for
yeah.
Some
it's a
somebody
fucking fly.
Yeah, like for somebody who's been spliced together with a fly is appropriate as hell.
Yeah, I wonder, and apparently off and on, David Cronenberg has considered remaking this film or doing a sequel. And I wonder just how much like more grotesque it would become in terms of like dealing with say like excrement or garbage a lot more, like a lot of like environmental rot.
Yeah.
Because there's character rot. There's not as much environmental rot. It gets messy, but it's still a messy warehouse. There's nothing intrinsically like inhuman about that. But, you know, if not Cronenberg, a lot of others have attempted to remake or do a sequel to this. And thankfully, this film remains untouched, with one exception. Would you like to know that exception? It's not what you think.
It's not The Fly 2 starring Eric Stoltz?
No, we're not going to talk about that. That doesn't count. That is some direct-to-DVD bullshit, direct-to-VHS bullshit. No, we're
talking about... Yeah, that's what I was about to say anyway.
Yeah, we are talking about the David Cronenberg-produced 2008 opera. that debuted in France. Written by Howard Shore. So he came back around and wrote an opera of this film. And apparently it's really quite good. Here's a clip.
Because I want this story, or is it because I still want you?
Stavis, you've got to stop this once and for all.
Then meet me tonight
in a public place.
If you insist.
Okay, I'm just legitimately fascinated by the idea of this as an opera.
Mm-hmm. And not like a joke either. This is a full-on fucking production. And when you look at the script, at how it is essentially, it's maybe three sets at most. You can get rid of the eating out restaurant ones.
Yeah.
You can find ways to write that into just coming back from places or eating back at the laboratory or at the office. But it's an office and it is a laboratory. That's it. Office laboratory. You've got two sets. You've got three characters and the action occurs entirely within those areas. It's a super straightforward to approach adapt for stage kind of piece, and because it is essentially still just like it's a teleplay, you know, you could find a way to send this back to 1958 and make it for like a television horror TV show. It wouldn't be good effects wise, but it could still be done. And so I love that they made something so wonderfully adaptable that they were like, yeah, let's come back to this and do it as, I don't know, an opera. Probably in French.
I mean, one would assume, and like, fuck it, why not?
Yeah, yeah. So, it's just, it's one of those films that always surprises you because like just the talent and the detail and the work that went into it. It surprises everyone in the fact that it's a cult classic horror film from the 80s that was financially successful and critically acclaimed at its time. Like there is no point when someone was like, hey, you know what's an underrated film? David Cronenberg's The Fly. This film has been heat since the minute it was released, and it made, I want to say, 5 to 6 times its box office back in its initial release for a fucking horror film in the 80s that wasn't a sequel.
Estimated budget of about 15 million US with a worldwide nine. IMDb says 15, so like for whatever that's worth.
Curious.
And I'm showing a worldwide gross here of a little over 60 million.
Yeah, so
about 4 times.
From 9, fantastic. From 5, yeah. From 15, still pretty goddamn
good. Still pretty sweet,
good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's still 4 times your budget?
Not exactly.
Bad. Not bad. And again, this is for a remake of a cheesy film done as a character study body horror at the peak of Jason and Freddy and a bunch of other fucking schlock. And around the same time as the failure of The Thing, which absolutely could be seen as being in the same vein as this. Though this came a little bit later and audiences seem to have smartened the fuck up.
Yeah. And, well, and also, based on one scene, I'm pretty sure there's at least five other movies that would have come out in roughly the same time period that you could connect to The Fly.
Yeah.
When Seth and Veronica go on that hamburger date early on.
Cheeseburger.
Thank you. The restaurant they're in. I'd swear I've seen that set in at least, like I said, four or five other movies from roughly that era.
I think you're right. I can't pin down any in my head right now, but it's like, it's a reused set. If not, a spot that like a lot of people go to. And it's like, yeah, no, that's perfect. Because like, I think that there's even like a bunch of like mob films shot in that one. There's something wonderfully 80s and 50s, early 60s about it. It's the perfect fucking diner.
Oh yeah, no, like the closest I could come to for specifics is I think one of them was a Schwarzenegger film, and one of them might have been an Eddie Murphy.
Maybe start planning some fan fictions there, kids.
you were talking earlier about how Cronenberg was pondering a remake.
Yeah.
Now, with that in mind, I would just like to take this opportunity to publicly thank Disney for buying Fox so that I don't have to beg Cronenberg not to take that potential remake to Fox. because this is the studio that did not want Jeff Goldblum as the lead.
Yeah. Yeah. He was not the original choice.
And the first thing that I thought watching this movie was, how does anyone but Jeff Goldblum play this role? Like 30 seconds of him on screen, I kept thinking to myself, that man already looks like a fly.
Yeah, he has a very distinct look. And now, to be fair, the person that they initially wanted for it has a distinct look too, but Jeff Goldblum's eyes are rather large and kind of,
yeah,
you know, he can get them to point in different directions. But and I love Jeff Goldblum, he's very handsome and stuff, but when he chooses to be grotesque, he's very good at it. But initially they wanted this to be John Lithgow, and I don't think it works. I don't think it works.
John Lithgow is... Oh, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but there was another episode that we did a while back where we were talking about how Harrison Ford was being suggested as the potential lead, and I think Jack Nicholson came up in the conversation too, and we were both kind of going, yeah, I see it, but and it's the same thing here. I can see the logic behind wanting John Lithgow, but I think for a role like this, and considering it was Jeff Goldblum, this feels weird to be saying this, but I think Lithgow might have played it a little too manic.
No, I think you're right. He would have played it a little too manic, a little too, like, I don't know, a little too cartoonish. And not that Lithgow can't do serious. You know, The Trinity Killer was very serious and well done on Dexter. But he, first of all, he hadn't exactly gotten to that point with characters on film yet. This was around the same time as Buckaroo Banzai. So consider his character from that.
Yeah.
And then know that a Fox executive saw that and went, yeah, that's the energy I'm looking for. Fantastic. And I think it's a mistake because, and obviously was not acted upon, because part of the real terror and horror of this film, in fact, I'd like to point out that the entirety of the horror of this film is from the female perspective. Goldblum's character, Brundle, has a few moments of like, oh God, what am I becoming? But for the most part, he's enthralled by either the genius to discovery of all this that he is, or the physical outcome of like becoming part spider, part fly man, like very strong, very focused, all of that stuff, the drive, the animalistic aggression. And then in the end, he's too wrapped up with like his flyish schemes to give a shit. All of this is driven by the fear of the predicaments that Geena Davis's character finds herself in constantly. And it's not just Goldblum. It's her predatory, vindictive ex-boyfriend who is her boss, who also, aside from making a lot of inappropriate comments, when they break up, he holds on to a key to her property.
Yeah.
He can just break in, and her only way of responding to that is to just like hope that he isn't a complete bastard, you know, knowing full well that apparently he's such a prick that she's broken up with him and is considering leaving the paper they work for. But like she has to just be like, okay, and placate him on the hopes that he doesn't become a violent lunatic, like say Brundlefly becomes, who attempts, like, after impregnating her, and she wants to get, you know, she wants to regain some control over her body and get rid of this fucking thing, attempts to super assert by forcing the baby Brundlefly and Geena Davis to become one being, thus losing all final control over her body. This is after he has attacked her multiple times and, like, become more and more and more aggressive. This entire fucking film is actually about like abusive male partners and being stuck in a series of abusive relationships with men. But it's also about a disgusting fucking fly monster.
If I had one complaint about the movie, it would have been the character of Stathis. Just in how he starts off as this misogynistic, almost incel-ish. Actually, I'm more hesitant when I say almost than I realized, now that I'm thinking about it. Well,
but and like that, you know, reading it from now, absolutely. But at the time, in the 80s, he's a go-getter man's man, and Brundle's a nerd. And like that was the approach. It's the 80s. He's a pig, but he's also a boss being a man in 80s society. The reason that he ultimately, quote unquote, like saves the day in the end is like, it's not commented on in any kind of feminist aspect. Yes, he's deformed. He's badly scarred, possibly even dead from this. I can't remember because they kind of just let him like drop off there. We've got Brundlefly's heads to explode.
Yeah, like he doesn't die on screen, but let's be honest.
Exactly, but like it's done to be a foil to Brundlefly, who starts off as an awkward but seemingly nice guy and becomes a violent, dangerous threat. And this guy is a known, not violent, dangerous threat, but dickhead just a known dickhead. And though he doesn't go through any kind of character arc, he's still a fucking dickhead by the end. He at least does the right thing in trying to save Gina Davis's life. And it's like the only there. Yeah, it's just a whole comment on like how she is stuck in this world of assholes and just trying to survive.
Oh, yeah. Like, I get that Stathis towards the end of the movie is supposed to be the proverbial lesser of two evils.
And isn't that, wow, what a win for feminism.
Yeah. He comes off more as suddenly going from misogynistic asshole to friendly, supporting character. So it's like they took him too far in the other direction.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, it would actually be welcomed at this point if you'd say something chauvinistic, dickhead character, so that we can know that, okay, no, they haven't just swapped your name out for another character who was here. You are still the same person. Like, just drop in something or slap your ass on the way to the final confrontation or something. Show us that you're that same asshole.
Basically, yeah. Like, that was the one thing that I just couldn't let go. Like, there were some things, like, the relationship, I thought, between Veronica and Seth moved a little too quickly.
I mean,
but at the same time, it felt like they were trying to get to the disintegration of Seth's character.
Yeah, so I can go, one of those things.
So I can go, that was a little fast, but I see why it was a little fast.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily fast. Like, the details are that they've been together for years. Like, he was a professor in college. They've been together for years. They've had a complex relationship. So I can understand that he would also be capable of, say, being empathetic to her, talking to her. Otherwise, she probably would have dumped his ass a little earlier, even though he absolutely groomed her. That's the other
Lord,
thing. He groomed her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He groomed her. Yeah. But, like, yeah, there just need to be a little more on-screen presentation of that switch. Because, yeah, I can understand how that's realistic in terms of how actual humans are. But what we're watching is a narrative.
Yeah.
And narratives need to have logical connective tissue. You can't just have neurons firing off so that one time some character is actually a nice guy due to outside interference stresses and environmental reasons and interpersonal reasons that are just too complicated to get into in a movie that is an hour and 28 minutes.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. Like I said, once I could see that, okay, they're clearly just focusing on the disintegration of Seth as a human being. It's like, okay, I see why you skipped over this, and this. We are good.
Yeah. There's a way to make this film longer, absolutely, and include a few things. But again, a part of its power is in how tight it is, how it's just done. We're good. Like, there were multiple, endings to this before they chose to go with the blow Brundlefly's head off and hard cut to black. And a couple of them involve, like, giving birth to a child. And in one, there's, like, a normal kid. And in another, her nightmare scenario comes true. But there's a magical, super, super happy ending where she gives birth to a butterfly. And it's like,
what?
This film could have been extended. It could have kept going. But yeah, like, one of the versions is she gave birth to a butterfly, which may or may not have been like a dream, but also fuck it at that point.
I would have hoped that that was a dream sequence.
You would hope, like, audiences reacted badly to it, so it doesn't matter. It'll never happen, but I'm really fascinated by the ways that, like, to get to such a great film, there was bad creative decisions made. They were just, you know, made and then learned from and not repeated.
Yeah, because like the dream sequence where she gets Stathis to take her to have an abortion, I almost had an issue with that because, again, it feels like jumping point to point to point. And then it was, oh, dreams. Oh, okay.
Yeah, dream
now
logic.
Now it's making sense.
It's a very good sequence. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a really well done one because, yeah, it draws you in. You don't know that you're in a dream sequence. It's not overtly slapping you in the face with anything.
No.
Even when you see the giant larva, you're still like, yeah, but there's literally a fly guy. So I will assume that this is realistic until she wakes up. And you're like, I've been had.
Well, I think the larva was where I kind of started to put those first couple pieces together, just because I'm sitting there going, okay, wait, she didn't even have like a pregnancy belly when she went in, and that came out of her? Now, not an expert on female anatomy or anything, but questions.
I mean, yeah, you know, it's giving birth to a larva. Who knows where that gets stored? Maybe it's in her legs. I don't know.
And I mean, she wakes up like 4 seconds later. So,
yeah, yeah. So no, it's a really good gotcha. And it's the difference between a gotcha and a jump scare is a gotcha is sudden relief in the middle of tension and fear, and it's far better to use a gotcha than a jump scare because it like it makes what comes later even worse. It makes the anticipation of, oh, I thought I was watching bad. Nope, turns out there's worse coming. And that was just like a prelude, a promise, if you will, of holy fuck, this gets worse. Oh good. Yay. Whereas a jump scare is just a fucking jump scare. It makes you go, ah, and then you get like serotonin hangover and adrenaline mouth, and it's like, oh fuck off, you know. It's setting your audience up to fail midway through your film and then be annoyed at you. Always go with relief over jump scare. Always. That's just chemistry.
Yeah, but on the plus side of jump scares, usually there's a cat.
Yeah. Now, and if you must use a jump scare, use it at the very end or only once.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Ever. Ever. And anyway, there are no jump scares in this. There is only delicious, delicious. Are you watching? We're not turning the camera away, so you better be watching. Slopping off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Blah, blah. Fantastic. The work that they do with like the acid burning the hand, it's so good. Just like watch it melt down. Yes, are you still watching? Good, we need you to understand how much this hurts.
Oh yeah, no, I'll tell you right now, that was the moment I almost had to run out of the lunchroom because I was going to get sick. I have no problem admitting that.
It's funny because there's not much visual difference between that and, say, the Nazi melting in Raiders of the Lost Ark. But this is far more visceral. There's something about this that is more disgusting. And it's not just because one
actually
of them's a Nazi.
I think I have a basic idea of what that difference might be. That the sequence here is a little smoother than what it is in Raiders.
That's true.
Yeah, like Raiders, to my mind anyway, it was a little more stop motion.
And it can be, it jumps between a few other things, and it's a little choppier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. But like, such a brilliantly well done, well executed film that deserves all of its credit and respect that it gets. It's a fantastic film. If you haven't seen The Fly, then why? Why? Go watch The Fly. Buzz, fly.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely see it. You may not want to see it again, but definitely see it.
I suggest eating brisket while watching this.
Oh, but I think one final thing to note is to go back to how Fox did not want Jeff Goldblum. If that Fox executive had gotten their way, can you imagine how many impressionists' careers would not have taken off as a result?
Sorry, I'm suddenly distracted by the concept of John Lithgow, but...
Because there's a second restaurant scene where Jeff Goldblum is suddenly going off on this semi-improvised monologue.
Mm.
That from his cadence, like, that is the scene that launched 1,000 Jeff Goldblum impressionists.
Absolutely. The energy, convinced. The intensity, the stumbling of it all. Wonderfully well done.
Like
that's all you need to get a sense of Jeff Goldblum. Absolutely. Dr. Ian Malcolm is, of course, like the uber all perfect Jeff Goldblum. But if you want to get an impression, The Fly.
Yeah, like as the risk is our business speech launched many a William Shatner impression. So many comedians would have pulled their impressions from that scene in The Fly. Like, I'm sorry, it's just everything that you would need to learn Jeff Goldblum is right there.
Yeah, it's the most Jeff Goldblum thing. Like, it's a moment of pure Goldblum. It Goldblooms. But with that, we're finally done. It's done for another year. Halloween has officially ended on November 28th. And we're going to watch something else soon. What are we actually going to watch next?
Well, I did want to do the 2020 animated film Wolfwalkers as kind of a transition out of horror. But scheduling and time-wise, I don't think it's going to work.
We can definitely find another excuse to do it.
Sometime,
well, like in the new year.
Oh no, it's totally going to come at some point down the road. But we have to jump straight into the upcoming David Harbour film Violent Night, because, like, really, we've put ourselves through hell with all of this body horror. Oh, like, what's better to follow that with some good old fashioned Christmas schlock?
Oh yeah, we are rolling hard with the schlock. We are going into the merriest time of the year with some of the crappiest gay shit ever. It's nothing but Yuletide shit from here on. Enjoy. Because I'm gonna.
Oh, amen to that.
And if you were excited, please let us know. Share with us. Comment, like, subscribe, hand out copies of it to your friends, Xerox it, and add it to your punk zine that you hand out to all of the other lonely teenagers. Or contact us over email. Probably easier to do that. Mike, where would they send that missive to?
Well, you can send it, or if you would like to suggest some truly terrible holiday garbage for us to sift through, and we happily will, strange as that sounds, you can reach us at realgeekshfx@gmail.com. Or on Twitter at RealGeeksHFX. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and now Hive. I don't really check the Hive one a whole lot right now, but I do have it at The Maritime Lord, or a little more directly at themaritimelord@gmail.com. And crash!
And I am available on Twitter for now, yes, still, at Friday in Halifax, unless Elon actually gets off his ass and releases all the old accounts, in which case I will choose from one of my 23. I counted. And amalgamate from there. But otherwise, I can be found at Crash and Burn pretty much anywhere. If you can't find Crash and Burn, I ain't there. Thank you very much.
Oh, simple yet effective.
So easy, so nice, so lazy. But until next time, goodbye.
See ya.
Forever she will be mine.